The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Dominic Pileggi. I'm the Majority Leader of the Pennsylvania Senate. I represent the 9th District, which includes portions of Delaware and Chester counties. I've served on the board of my local library for over 10 years. Last year, my legislation to modernize Pennsylvania's library code for the first time in 50 years was signed into law by Governor Corbett. I believe that libraries are critical to an informed citizenry and a healthy democracy. The Free Library carries out this critical work each and every day by advancing literacy, promoting learning, and inspiring curiosity in the Philadelphia region. Tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012, a compelling account of the 2012 presidential election. Veteran political reporters John Heilman and of the New York Magazine and MSNBC, and Mark Halperin of Time and MSNBC, set the national conversation with their number one New York Times best-selling account of the 2008 presidential campaign, Game Change. The HBO adaptation won 5 Emmy Awards. The New York Times described Double Down this way: "The book testifies to its author's energetic legwork and insider access, creating a novelistic narrative that provides a you-are-there immediacy. They succeed in taking readers interested in the backstabbing and backstage maneuvering of the 2012 campaign behind the curtains." I've been on the ballot 7 times in the 20 years I've been involved in politics. A lot has changed during that time, especially how campaigns are run. This firsthand, timely account of the 2012 presidential election is a must-read for all of those interested in the political process. Tonight's authors will be in conversation with Dick Palman, national political columnist for WHYY's Newsworks and writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming John Heilman and Mark Halperin.
Welcome, everybody. I'm glad to see such a good crowd for a rainy night, and I'll take that as a testament to the skill of our guests tonight. This is Mark Halperin on my left and John Heilman on my right. I'm going to converse with them for a bit, and at some point we're going to have questions. And so please bear with me. If you have questions, please hold them until then. We'll let you know. But I was just curious, off the top of my head, when I was reading the book, I was thinking back to campaign books, starting with the first campaign book, one that everybody recognizes, the bestseller, Theodore H. White's The Making of the President in 1960, and it's in the last half century, it's become a tradition to do these campaign books. Jules Witkover and Jack German, the late Jack German, did a series of them, and you guys have now done a couple of them. And I was just wondering do you see your books in the tradition of those books? At least in terms of what they try to do to recap the elections and give us sort of a dramatic sweep. But if so, you know, obviously times have changed, and so you might perhaps want to amend your answer, even if you do see it in the tradition. So either one of you.
Well, first, thanks for having us here tonight. And as Dick said, it's great on a rainy night like this, so close to the holiday, for all you guys to come out. We're really appreciative. We're at the end of two straight weeks of doing events like this from coast to coast and back to the other coast and then back to this coast. I can say with really no fear of contradiction that this is the best place we've been. We love Philadelphia more than any other place. I can promise you I've not said that any other place in the country. Yes is the answer in short. When we sat down to think about writing the first book, we were obviously, we've been covering presidential politics for a couple decades each, and we were intimately familiar with all of the you just mentioned Teddy White, obviously a giant and someone who pioneered this form of journalism and made the campaign narrative something that people expected and understood as a viable form. We had a bunch of other giants who we looked at as people we really admired and not sought to emulate, but just sort of shoulders that we tried to stand on. We're both big fans of Hunter Thompson's book on the 72 campaign, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. And you mentioned Jack Germont and Jules Woodcover, of course, did some great books. And Richard Ben Kramer, who is a Philadelphia Inquirer alum, who wrote a great book about the 1988 campaign called What It Takes. All those books were different. They were of their times. They had different... each of them broke through in a different way, but they all had at least one big thing in common, which is that they were all trying to get beyond what the daily coverage brought to bear. And again, daily coverage has really changed since 1960. And by the time that we sat down to think about these two books, it had changed even more, and there was so much coverage. But all of them had an essential quality that was the same, which was they kind of wrote about the high human drama of running for president and tried to focus to a large extent on what this kind of incredible American spectacle, incredibly high-stakes competition for the most powerful position in the world, what it was like for these people, all of whom are incredibly ambitious and narcissistic and egomaniacal and idealistic, all, you know, and we really thought if we could, in this hyper-drive media environment, if we could stick to those principles and show what the campaign was like for these people, the people closest to them, how their strengths and weaknesses were manifest on the campaign trail, how they affected the outcome of the race, how the race affected them as human beings, that there would be, you know, 50 years after Teddy White and 40 years after Hunter Thompson and 20 years after Richard Ben Kramer, there'd still be an interest and a market for that. And to the extent that people have been interested in our books, it's turned out to be true. I'll say one last thing, which is that all of those books by all those authors are great, fantastic. But not a single one has achieved what we have managed to achieve with this book, Double Down, which is none of them had the endorsement of the North Korean State News Agency. And I'm not kidding about that. Just the other day, we caught a headline in the Washington Post which said, North Korea endorses Double Down as proof that, quote, the U.S. is the root cause of all sorts of evils. And I'm sure you all know that there is only one book club in the world more important than the Oprah Book Club, and that's the Kim Jong-un Book Club. So we're proud to be the book of the month for that club.
Mark, do you have anything to add to that?
Just a little bit. I agree with all what John said. Thank you all for coming out, as was said, on a rainy night. And it's nice to see so many people here. This is one of the few cities in America with a lot of, you know, intense interest in politics and a lot of political interest. I feel like to Senate President Kennedy, much in the news, to paraphrase one of President Kennedy's famous lines, is this is the most Philadelphia political savvy in one room, with the possible exception of when Ann Rendell dined alone. So always a little daunting to speak here because I know you all know a lot. All I'll say is that you know, because all those books are great books and we're honored and never anybody mentions us in that breath with them, but there is a challenge now because of the speeded up news cycle to publish a book and have people still be interested. And people often say to us, you know, it's a year after the election. How could anyone possibly still care given all the coverage that went on? And with all due respect to someone who's a friend of ours, you know, it took Doris Kearns Goodwin like 100 years to get the Roosevelt book out. So I feel like we're doing okay in taking just a year. The challenge for us is to tell the story in a different way than we're able to and our colleagues are able to in daily coverage and Twitter and weekly coverage and even a monthly magazine. And that involves doing 500 interviews for the book, which is a lot more interviews than most people do for projects, and particularly covering a campaign, and to try to, as John said, tell the story through the eyes of the candidates and their families with as much empathy as possible, journalistic distance, and storytelling. And the last thing I'll say, and again, there are elements of this in the books you mentioned, Dick, you know, we try to write these books for multiple audiences. And I'll do a quick survey just to get a sense here. I ask you to vote by show of hands. If you're uncomfortable voting in front of others, you can close your eyes as you vote. How many people haven't read Double Down? Raise your hand. Have not. Okay. And how many of you have read it? All right. Relatively few of you have read it. I don't want to say too much about the plot right now. I don't want to give away the ending. But but it is the case that we focus on relationships as much as anything else. So often political insiders will say to us, people involved in the campaigns, the candidates will say, you know, not only did you have your facts right, but you had the feel of things, the smell of things right in a way that requires interviewing 500 people and really trying to get a sense of the story. But what heartens us equally is when people who aren't as interested in politics, who never read anything about politics, but who pick up our books and read them and decide that they just it's a good story about interesting people doing interesting things under a lot of pressure. There's elements of that in those other books that you mentioned, but we try as much as possible to write, again, not books that are political. They're not results of every primary and caucus and every poll, but rather, again, we focus on the people, the challenges they face, how they feel about those things, and the relationships they're in.
I was just curious also, well, we'll talk, I think, about the politics in the book, but staying with the writing process for a second. I was curious how you put it together. I mean, maybe, I don't know whether you did this in the first book as well, but how do you divvy up the writing and the reporting, if indeed you do divvy up? I mean, obviously, having read the book now, you know, the style is consistent throughout, but there's two of you. So, you know, do you both write it and then give it to each other? We'll start with the reporting. I mean, do you conduct the interviews jointly? For the most part?
We do probably for both books about 95% of the interviews together, which some people are surprised by. Given 500 interviews, you might think it'd be better to divide up and have separate people do separate interviews. In fact, we find part of what works for us in terms of a collaborative process is a shared sense of the story. And if you think about 500 interviews, we've got to be really well prepared for them. We interview a lot of people twice, big people, major characters involved. We might interview a dozen times.
Are they long interviews or short interviews?
They're very long interviews.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
2 or 3 hours or longer sometimes. And with some big people, we kind of embed with them maybe over the course of several days because we want to get the narrative. These are all like oral histories. And we need to sit through them together, prepare for them together, then figure out, all right, who do we need to interview next? When do we need to go back to somebody? And doing all that, the few times we do them separately, it's very hard to kind of catch up and have the mind meld that we need. So in terms of preparation and execution of the interviews, analysis of the interviews, we find much better to do them together. And really the only times we don't do them together is when it becomes logistically impossible.
So we end up with, having done 500 in some interviews with 400 and some people, you end up with like 30,000 pages of transcripts. And that takes a long time to read those, even if you've been to Evelyn Wood, as we both have been, and are speed readers. You know, we read them, and we're building very decide what, in all of that information, there's a lot of it that's about things that we've decided along the way that are important to the narrative. We very rarely disagree about anything, which is another thing that people ask all the time, apart from, like, where to go to dinner. We don't really fight very much about the book process. So we decide what's going off the sled and what we want to focus on, and then after having developed very detailed outlines of every chapter and looked at all these transcripts and taken close notes and really come to a kind of conclusion about what's going to be in the book and what's not going to be in the book, we take all the notes and all the transcripts and all the outlines and we send them off to India, to Bangalore, where we outsource the writing to a team of
That's why the writing style is consistent.
Right. And they send the transcripts back, they send the writing back, and we just send it on to the publisher.
If you read carefully, you'll notice the voice of every tech support person you've ever had in the book.
But you get along in terms of...
We do.
You know, I mean, in terms of the writing process, what you do you, like, read each other's drafts of sections?
We pass everything back and forth a lot. We kind of amazing to us that we, in 2008... We didn't have either two of the modern collaborative writers' most essential tools. We had no Dropbox, and we had no FaceTime then. And Mark lives on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn. And rather than sharing office space, we keep a FaceTime window open pretty much for about 6 months, pretty much 24 hours a day, which is a little intrusive and a little invasive sometimes. But we are able to basically have, you know, real-time communication about everything we're doing as we go along. So if either one of us has a question about what turn to take next, we can, you know, hash it out right there on the spot. And that proves to be, it is kind of an amazing thing. I think even our wives are sort of surprised that we are, we almost never have thought about anything in the books. I mean, I can think in two straight books, there haven't been more than four or five occasions where one of us has thought something should be in the book and the other thought, no, that shouldn't be in the book. I mean, our shared sense about it. And we realized that when we first started doing the first book was that we had a remarkably similar ideas about what was interesting, what was funny, what was human, what was revealing. And that helps. I mean, if we were constantly squabbling, I'm sure we wouldn't have even done the second book, let alone ever thought about doing two and still be able to sit here and look at each other without wanting to beat each other senseless.
So in terms of, all right, you mentioned 500 interviews, 400 sources.
Ish.
400 sources.
Ish.
Thereabouts.
Ish.
Yeah.
Ish.
One of the things I was noticing, and just maybe for the people here who haven't read the book yet, you have a section at the end where you explain your process of how you work with these sources, because they all have what you call deep background, which is that you can use the material, but they're not identified in the text. You have sort of a narrative, which I guess we would call kind of like the omniscient fly on the wall kind of approach, very third person. So nobody is specifically identified as being, the attribution is not specifically identified with people on the record. Now, there's been, of course, as you guys well know, you know, over the years, some controversy in journalism about anonymous sources, and the term sometimes has a pejorative to it because of certain scandals that have erupted in the Washington Post and New York Times, et cetera. Explain for people here who might say, well, you know, why isn't anybody identified and how do we know who's talking? The value or perhaps the necessity of doing it the way you did it.
Yeah. We wouldn't get anything like the material we get if people were asked to go on the record. And it would be better if they would, but the reality, and again, we didn't invent this genre. It's been done over the years in not just political books, but books about business and sports and entertainment and other walks of life. People trust us in terms of our sources, but we're also asking our readers to trust us. We've both been doing this for over two decades, and we have our professional credibility on the line. The proof is in the pudding in terms of accuracy, factual accuracy, in the sense that in two books of this visibility, there's been almost no one who's challenged anything publicly that's in the book, and with all due respect to most of those who've challenged it, often they were the sources of the material they were challenging. And there's not been a single challenge that has been accurate, because we're extraordinarily careful because of the visibility of the books. It is a lot to ask people to trust us, but the books are accurate, and as I said at the beginning, wouldn't get the material we get. People just aren't willing to, for the interviews, which is the majority of them conducted after the election, they just aren't willing to expose themselves the way they would have to if their names were attached to it. And we take it really seriously. Sometimes people will say, without direct knowledge, in writing about our books or talking about our books, that we rely on sources with axes to grind. Just not true. Yes, sometimes we do interview people who have an axe to grind or a point of view or an agenda, but because we're interviewing 500 people and because we're pretty experienced and because we have relationships with almost everybody we interviewed for the book of long standing, we're able to factor that in. It doesn't really matter to us in the end what their motivations are. What matters is what's accurate. And 500 interviews allows you to figure out what's accurate. Again, not just in terms of facts, but in terms of emphasis, in terms of what things feel like, because that, in the way we write these books, that's as important as the facts, which aren't really important, but so is, again, the overall feel of the thing. And that can be influenced, if we did fewer interviews, perhaps by people with an agenda, but we're just not susceptible to that because of the number and because of, our knowledge of the point of view that people are bringing to these discussions.
I'll say three things about that briefly, one of which is just expanding on what Mark said a second ago, which is that I find it strange always when people ask this question, what are your sources, what are their agendas, and are they trying to spin history or whatever? And it's like, you know, Dick, you know this is true because you did journalism and, you know, still do journalism. It's like what journalists do all day, every day. I mean, your sources, every source you talk to, sometimes they're driven by pure idealism. Sometimes they have an agenda. Sometimes they don't have an agenda. But this is what newspaper journalists, magazine journalists, web journalists, broadcast journalists do every day, is try to pick through the sources and evaluate the agendas of their various sources and figure out not what the sources, what their agendas are, but what is true, what happens, what is real. And if you get to the point where you believe something's true and it's important, you put it in the book. And it doesn't matter what, in the end, as Mark said, what their agenda, what their motives are. The second thing I'll say about anonymous sources is just, you know, every day in your newspapers, from the New York Times to every local newspaper, the notion of blind sources is commonplace. And so you read on the front page of the New York Times a story that says, Barack Obama walked into the White House and said, I'd like to have a slice of pizza, according to one person who was in the room. And then he asked for a Coke, according to another close observer who was in the room. And we write, Barack Obama walked into the room, asked for a pizza and a Coke. And people will say, well, I can't believe you guys don't identify the source for that. And I say, well, if it was in the New York Times and you said, according to someone in the room, you know, it's not really any different, right? I mean, that's exactly the same thing, except we just don't put according to someone in the room. We explain in the back of the book that all the dialogue in the book is witnessed by someone who was in the room, and there's a kind of overarching thing for the sourcing there. This is a very common thing to do, and I'll say that some of our colleagues in books do something that I think is equally hilarious, which is the notion of footnoting things. And then at the end in the footnotes, they say, from an interview with an anonymous Obama administration insider on such and such a date, as if that is any different, as if that somehow gives you any greater degree of credibility. In the end, every author is putting their credibility on the line. And that's, I'll say, the third thing to what Mark said about challenges to the book. I'll just tell you one story because I think you'll think it's funny. We certainly do. The most strident challenger of a fact in the first book in Game Change was Liz Cheney. Who, when we reported that her father had the reaction to the choice of Sarah Palin as John McCain's running mate, we said that Dick Cheney had said that it was a reckless choice. And Liz Cheney came out when the book came out, and she said, that's absolutely not true. My father would never say that. She would never say that about the great Sarah Palin under no circumstances. He did not say that. I deny it vehemently on his behalf. And we were a little bit like, well, it's Liz Cheney. You know, she has reasons to do that, but it's hard to fight with her about it. And about a year or two later, Dick Cheney did an interview in which, on television, which one of the journalists asked him, what did you think of Sarah Palin as her selection for as John McCain's running mate? He said, oh, I thought it was a reckless choice. We were somewhat pleased with that, although it would have been nice if it had been a little bit closer to when the book was published.
Yeah, actually, and, go ahead.
Well, and just to emphasize, as John said, when people do challenge us, we don't like to be in public fights with them. So, like, we didn't want to be in a fight with Liz Cheney. Unlike her sister, who's happy to do that, we feel like it's not really our place to pick fights. But there are examples like the one John cited where people have maybe some interest to challenge it. But even those cases have been few and far between. Given the sort of visibility of the people we write about, for instance, the Clintons, we write about extensively in both books. The Clintons have a long history of attacking the accuracy and credibility of books written about them, and they've been absolutely silent in the face of both books and not challenged them.
Right, yeah. They have a very good sort of knock the story down impulse.
Yes, they
all
do.
The time.
Often before it appears.
Yeah. Right. They get their proactive machine going. All right, so in terms of, here's a few of the things that I gleaned from the book that I think are fun, and I think speak to, I guess, you know, how politics is such a contact sport.
Yeah.
And it's just so personal, and the way people sort of go at each other. And I'm not giving anything away in the big picture here, but we have just some great direct quotes, all right? Obama said of Bill Clinton, I like him in doses. All right, that was one. Tim Pawlenty, some of you may remember who that is. Tim Pawlenty called Michelle Bachmann insane. Right, quote unquote. George W. Bush called Rick Perry a chicken shit guy. All right, sorry for the cable language here.
So far, these all have the ring of truth.
The ring of truth to you, right? And Mike Murphy, the Republican strategist, called Romney's strategist Stuart Stevens an idiot. So it sets up a question. Okay,
those are mild.
I was trying to find the ones that everybody can sort of. All right. Yeah. So it's a very flesh and blood kind of process here, and. What I was struck by also, you know, you've got these scenes in the book where Mitt Romney is clearly sleep deprived and making mistakes in part because he is sleep deprived. And Rick Perry, perhaps some of his mistakes were attributed to the fact that he was sick and he had a back condition. I'm thinking that some of those things, how much of those things do you think really in add up to affecting an election? The interpersonal bumper cars nature of politics and whether it really does in the end move votes, because I'm thinking of this book that came out, which I'm sure you're familiar with, called The Gamble, that these two political scientists published, which makes the argument, I think, essentially that there really aren't very many, that the flesh and blood aspect of politics is overrated, and that sort of, you know, hardly any votes get moved by all the ads and all the campaign collisions and all the kind of stuff that is really the part and parcel of your book. Do you disagree with that analysis? Are they wrong, or is it, or do you have to sort of think of the books as complementary in a way?
Yeah. This book was written by two political scientists who apparently want to put us out of business because their thesis is, again, that this stuff doesn't matter. I'll say two things. One is, in my experience, this stuff does matter. To me, the most important thing determines the outcome of a presidential election, where the earned media, the press coverage matters a lot more than the advertising, is whether you can control your public image, whether voters think about you the way you want them to think about you, or they think about you the way your opponents think about you. And you think about Governor Romney in the 47% video, some of the other gaffes he made. You think about at the convention on the night of his acceptance speech when he was hoping to have the eyes of the nation upon him. They let Clint Eastwood get up on the stage and do a running Bob Newhart imitation, just talking to an empty chair. Those are big moments that impact the coverage and I think impact their chances of winning within the confines, as that their book argues, of macroeconomics and other big factors that also play a role. But the other thing is, we're writing, as John said, about the high human drama of what it's like to run for president or be married to someone who runs for president. That doesn't necessarily mean we're saying every dramatic or humorous scene in the book impacted the outcome in some linear way, but it does tell an interesting story about people and relationships and the way running for president is experienced. Again, that doesn't make the argument that everything that happens in the book affects the outcome, but it's just hopefully an interesting story, well told with interesting characters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I totally agree, and I just don't see. It's, to me, the world is full of these false binaries, you know, where it's like it's one or the other. It's like either, you know, it was all. I mean, if it's the case that all that the election is a math equation. And we can, on the basis of some economic variables and some other variables, can all plug all this stuff into an equation. We know what the outcome is. It seems like we shouldn't really bother running the elections at all. I think, you know, it's obviously the case that the macroeconomy matters. And it's obviously the case that there are things that are measurable and don't have to do with the human qualities of the candidates that don't matter. I would say in a nomination fight in particular, it might be less true. The macro variables, I think, matter more for sure in a general election and in a general election where there's an incumbent. There's no question about that. And their book, probably that book, The Gamble, which is a very good book, is most applicable in some cases to the circumstances that we were just fighting. Doesn't really explain a lot of what happens in a nomination fight. Doesn't explain what happened between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008. Mm-hmm. Doesn't explain what happened in the Republican nomination fight this time. And I don't think they would claim it does. They're the human qualities, the stuff that Mark talked about in terms of free media, what the filter says, how the media covers it, how people perceive things when things are more wide open, especially within a party. All these things are factors and facts. But I do, you know, there's a weird deterministic quality to the notion that none of this stuff matters. And, you know, there's in the book, you mentioned Bill Clinton, and we can talk more about that, but, you know, President Clinton gave a speech in Charlotte that President Obama thought was very important. And he gave a speech that many people saw.
At the convention
in Charlotte, Democratic convention. Many people saw that speech, and it was kind of a tour de force. President Clinton defended President Obama's record, eviscerated the Republicans, and so on. In an incumbent election where the right track, wrong track numbers, which is, again, according to political scientists, is that one of the most important empirical variables for re-election for a president. The president had been way underwater, upside down, on that metric for all of 2011 and most of 2012, where 60% of the country thought the country was on the wrong track. Almost nothing economically changed between the last week in August and the second week in September. But the right track, wrong track numbers turned around, and they were, the president's numbers changed by about 10 points. In the 7 days after Bill Clinton spoke in Charlotte. And when Governor Romney's pollster was asked over and over again by his colleagues, how could this have happened after a year and a half where these numbers did not move, Governor Romney's pollster, a man, a big fan of numbers and an empiricist if ever there was one, would say it was Bill Clinton. I've never seen anything like it before in my life, but Bill Clinton changed that dynamic in the electorate and certainly fired up the Democratic base with the Obama campaign, also very empirical and very data-driven, thought was super important. So, you know, it's some mix. And I will never believe that it's either or. You know, it's and both. And, mm-hmm. and we're telling one side of that story.
Mm-hmm. There, all right, so you mentioned, we're talking about the drama, the high drama, as you mentioned in the book and as you've said here. Would you ideally have liked what do we need for high drama? We need exciting protagonists, ideally, right? Would you ideally have liked someone other than Mitt Romney to write about as a Republican nominee?
Are you asking if we think that if instead of being Romney, Ryan had been Palin, Trump, that would have been better
well,
for us?
Somewhere between Palin and Romney lies a fertile ground, don't you think?
I mean, we write about some of the people who didn't run, like Donald Trump, Mike Huckabee, Haley Barbour, who are maybe arguably more colorful characters than Mitt Romney. I'll say two things. One is we have to cover the campaign that happens, so we can't invent a nominee. We're writing nonfiction here. And the other is, you know, we'll let others be the judge, but we're very proud of our portrait of Mitt Romney. And if you take a step back from the sort of conventional wisdom that he's not a very compelling guy, in terms of his biography, in terms of his psychology, in terms of how he experienced his campaign, we think he's a pretty interesting character. And we think the way we were able to get access to writing about him in a way that others hadn't necessarily done, things we hope people find interesting, as along with people like Newt Gingrich and the president and the Clintons, who are also pretty darn interesting characters.
And sometimes instead of high human drama, we're perfectly content with high human comedy. You know, you have in the Republicans, on the Republican side, you had a fair number of things that were at least, you know, gave us a few moments to laugh. You know, you had Michelle Bachmann confusing the hometowns of John Wayne and the serial killer John Wayne Gacy.
It's always good for that.
Herman Cain and his references to Uzbeki, Becky, Becky, Stan. And Newt Gingrich ending his political career by doing a tour of America's zoos and being bitten by a penguin. So, you know, there are worse scenes to write than those scenes.
Yeah, isn't Bachman the one that also said that popular vaccine for young women causes mental retardation?
I believe she did say that. Yes,
she did say that. Yeah. Well, what did you learn? All right, so Barack Obama is president for another 3 years. Is there anything you learned about him in your reporting that perhaps can help us understand where he is today politically?
Oh, I think a ton of things. First of all, he likes to be surrounded by a small circle of aides, and that has served him well politically, but not necessarily as well in terms of running the government. One of the things we think emerges from the book is a bit of a paradox about the president. He doesn't really like politics, and in fact, we write about some pretty big scenes in the book, including on the eve of the critical second debate with Mitt Romney, where President Obama engages in some sort of soul-searching and open existential discussion about how he doesn't like the phoniness of politics as personified by the debates. He doesn't really like the stage managing and the theatricality. So he doesn't like politics, but he's very good at it in the sense that he's got elected president twice, first African-American president, winning re-election against a very tough economy. So doesn't like politics, but he's very good at it. He loves governing. He loves policy. He loves trying to use public policy and the instrument of government to try to get things done. But he's not proven, and certainly not right now, to be as good at that as he is at politics. So the thing he loves, he's not very good at. And the thing that he doesn't like, he's quite good at. So that's one thing. And that's the second thing I'd say, or third thing, this insular, and then this thing about government and politics, is, you know, he ran for re-election basically saying in the last year of the first term, done dealing with Republicans. He had a budget face-off with them in the summer of 2011, got a deal but was perceived as weak by both Republicans and a lot of Democrats, and basically said, I can't get anything else done without a new mandate. I'm going to spend the last year of this term just running for re-election, and when I win, the fever will break, that's the term he used in public and private, and I'll be able to then have momentum into my second term to get things done. That turned out to be, so far at least, a huge miscalculation, in part because Republicans, who have been determined to destroy his presidency and keep him from accomplishing much, even from before he got sworn in, didn't like being beaten up for a year and don't seem to have any additional incentive, maybe less of an incentive, to work with him now than they did before. And I think part of the president's problem now is Republicans don't like him. he's not courted Democrats the way a Bill Clinton or a Lyndon Johnson did his own party. The business community is not particularly pleased with a lot of his agenda and record. And so he's left himself with relatively few allies and doesn't seem particularly inclined to turn that situation around. I think that leaves this term in some peril right now.
All right. Well, I was thinking specifically of this healthcare rollout and the website and this if you have your plan, you can keep your plan, period. Mm-hmm. When all this started happening in the last few weeks, did you say to yourselves, all right, given what you found out about his governing style or the way the White House or the administration operates, did you say to yourselves, oh, well, big surprise, or not? I mean, did it sound consistent with what you saw?
You just said big surprise with a lot of Philly, sarcasm. Yeah.
With total Philly facetiousness, yes. I mean, were you surprised by that, given what your understanding is about the governing style in the White House and the administration?
Well, I'd say yes and no. Yes, in one sense, which is that I don't think that either one of us would have imagined. The president thought that this election was more meaningful than his first election. He thought that, and one of the reasons why we think there's a fair amount of drama in this book is that you had a situation where the president was, his view was that his election in 2008, he was elected largely, and he was self-aware enough to know this. He didn't have that much of a record. He was inspirational. He had a vision of how to hopefully change Washington. And he was obviously a vessel for a lot of historical, he was freighted with a lot of historical meaning. People were voting for a hope, you know, not voting on the basis of his record. And he knew that. And so this re-election to him was really important because he thought people were going to be voting on the basis of what he'd done. He did a lot of big things in the first 4 years. And whether you like them or not, you know, the Affordable Care Act is a big thing. The stimulus was $800 billion to keep the country out of the second Great Depression was a big thing. Re-regulating Wall Street was a big thing. Bailing out the auto industry was a big thing. Very controversial things, but big things. And the president, I think, felt like this re-election would be either a validation of what he had done or a rejection. And he felt like that was an important thing. He also thought he would get a mandate to do more stuff. So he thought this election was more consequential. There's nothing more consequential to them than the Affordable Care Act. He knows that that was his legacy. And so if you ask me, was I surprised that they so thoroughly screwed up the implementation of the most important thing to President Obama, I think it's sort of shocking. And no matter nothing we've learned about the last 4 years could have led you to think that they could have botched this job as badly as they botched it to this point. On the other hand, to the point that Mark made, you know, the president is not, has because of the insularity of the people around him, the group, this very small group around him, you know, he's not been someone who's taken, he's got huge interest in policy. He does not have that much interest in administration. And so he's not been someone who's been interested in trying to make things run. He's, for most of the first term, he didn't really know, he rarely spoke to anybody in his cabinet. And I think on some occasions, there were some of those cabinet secretaries who he probably couldn't have picked out of a lineup, you know. So the running of the government was not something that he ever took that much great enthusiasm in, as opposed to coming up in a kind of academic, quasi-academic setting with the right answer in terms of policy, which he does care a lot about. So that the administrative element of it has fallen apart, I think, has not been totally surprising.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like to me there's still more reporting, you know, to be had about exactly what happened with the rollout.
For sure.
I was going to ask about Chris Christie, but instead I'm going to ask you guys, if you have questions out in the audience, my one urgent request would be to please frame questions and whatever sort of monologues you have about politics, you can save them for your Thanksgiving dinner and piss off your family. So we'll go around right here, sir.
It's been quite a while since a president successfully concluded a second term. Can this job be done anymore?
Well, it's tough. I mean, we've had three straight two-term presidents. Hasn't happened in this country going all the way back to the beginning. So I think that the country's become more polarized, even though the last three presidents have all run to try to change that. And I think until that changes, given the political media environment in which you have to govern, it's very tough. Once you become a lame duck, once you've used kind of the mojo of your initial honeymoon period, it is very tough to govern. But I think that as we travel around the country all the time, we run into people who ask that question, not from an antiseptic point of view, but from a concern point of view. It's in all of our interest to have a government that functions and a president who can unite the country and and lead all of us. So I think we got to all look to change the system in a way that would allow that to happen. And it starts with, again, something all three of them have failed on, President Obama, most of all by every metric, with the help of Republican intransigence, which is got to change the culture of Washington so the parties are willing to work together. Because even if someone has a big enough majority to ram stuff through, as we saw with the Democrats and health care, it doesn't solve the problem because then implementation becomes a war every day in a way that's just not in the public interest for the challenges we face right now.
Over on this side.
Do you think the Republicans in the next 2016 nomination cycle will revert to the Tea Party again and have a really conservative lean to their candidate?
Well, I don't know if the Republicans have, it would be a reversion, right? I mean, the Tea Party was more powerful in 2012 coming out of the 2010 elections. They were a new force. They were very powerful coming out of the 2010 election, and yet they ended up with, the Republican Party ended up with Mitt Romney as its nominee, who was not a favorite of the Tea Party, and all the candidates who were beloved of that wing of the party didn't really go very far. I think Mark and I both agree the Tea Party will be less powerful in 2016 than it was in 2012, and again, in 2012, they didn't get their way. The Republicans since Goldwater, the right wing of the Republican Party, has not ever nominated its favorite. The mainstream or mainstream conservative in the case of Ronald Reagan, although he wasn't the furthest to the right when he ran in 1980 of that field, the mainstream conservative candidate generally wins the Republican nomination. I expect that'll probably be true again in 2016. But the question is whether that party, which right now is in the state of something like a total civil war, as bad as things are for the White House, the one bright spot for Democrats in general is that Republicans have done nothing in the last year to remediate the problems, the fundamental huge problems they have with large parts of the electorate that they would need to be able to do better with in order to win a national election again. They have not won a popular vote since 2004. They've lost five out of the last six popular votes in American presidential elections. The party is on the road right now to something that could be close to extinction. So the party needs to find someone who can unify the energy of its right flank with the establishment credibility of, you know, a candidate who could actually run the country and pull those two things together and then reach out to the center of the American electorate in a way that no one in the party has for the last, well, not since George W. Bush in 2004.
Someone in the back half, because we always overlook the people in the back. I see it.
The forgotten people in the back.
Okay. How extensively did you interview Mitt Romney, especially after the election, and how did you find him as a person?
Thank you for asking. We never can disclose who we talked to for the book, so I couldn't speak to whether we interviewed Governor Romney or not, and therefore I couldn't speak to how we found him. If we did interview him, I couldn't speak to how we found him then. In general, based on the interviews we did for the book totally, I think he's a pretty misunderstood figure in the sense that he's got a better sense of humor than people realize. He's got a more diverse and kind of quirky set of interests than I think people realize. And he's extraordinarily optimistic about America, his family, all sorts of things, except about himself. About himself, he's quite dark and kind of brooding for a variety of reasons. We talk about somewhat in the book. So as mentioned before, I think that the challenge if you run for president is to define yourself to the public at large better than the opposition's able to define you. And I think he really was very weak at that, and his team was very weak at that in protecting him. And so I don't think the public image of him is 180 degrees away from what he's really like. But how many people in this room have ever spent any time with Governor Romney? Yeah, not a lot. One right here. I guarantee you, well, I shouldn't say I guarantee, I would bet you that almost everybody in this room would like him a lot more after spending some time with him than you probably do now. Even if you like him a little bit, I think you'd like him a lot if you spent time with him. But he just didn't have the skills to project that in the forums, television and speeches and debates, except maybe in the case of the first debate, where he has the opportunity to meet people because the country's just too big for him to meet people, a lot of people face-to-face. That having been said, face-to-face, he can be quite awkward, as he showed time and again in campaigning on the ground and in some of the gaffes he made. He's just, we quote Bill Clinton in the book talking about Governor Romney saying he's in the long line of work. He shouldn't have a job where he's asked to speak to people in public. And that's, that's kind of the job description of a politician.
Yeah, and as we're going to take that question in the back, but I was just going to make a quick comment that what's so striking about the first half of the book is how many Republicans well-heeled Republicans, prominent Republicans, were also saying that, oh, he's just so bad on the stump.
Yep.
That was one of the reasons they wanted to find someone else.
Yeah, maybe the main reason.
Yeah. Right in the back there.
Were there people who you interviewed in the first book who declined to be participating in the second?
Of the 300 interviews and 200 sources-ish for the first book, and of the 500 interviews and 400 interviews-ish for the second book, so you're talking about 400 sources for the second book, and there's some overlap between the first two books, but we've really only had, in each case, fewer than 10, and I'd say closer to in the range of 5 or 6 for each book of people we've asked for interviews who've said no.
And none of those were people who were interviewed for the first book?
On the second book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi. Pennsylvania question. We've been a battleground state for a number of elections, but in this election...
Or at least Chris Matthews thinks you are.
That's right. Yeah. Well, he'd like to be in that battleground. But this election, we were skipped. And then at the end, in the last week, the Romney campaign decided to come in. I think they went to Bucks County.
They did.
So the first question is, why didn't Romney want to contest here? Because I do believe he could have played in Pennsylvania. And then why did they come in at the end?
They didn't contest because they had limited resources, and the polling suggested they were too far behind to make it up, and the coalition of the ascendant that President Obama stitched together to be so powerful in terms of the Electoral College and the battleground states, single women, African Americans, Hispanics, young people, really powerful in this state. And on issues like, for instance, funding for Planned Parenthood, Governor Romney left himself with a real deficit with the suburbs of the city that their pollster just thought was prohibitive. Had they been able to compete here, believe me, they would have, because they didn't have a very good margin of error in the Electoral College, but they never were all that close. The reason they came in at the end was because it wasn't a battleground state, there wasn't a lot of advertising. And although the earned media coverage matters a lot more, they looked at where things were, and there was a tightening at the end, as there was in most states, in a lot of states. They looked at it and said, well, maybe we can kind of steal the state because we didn't go through the kind of battering of negative ad after negative ad on TV for months, as we have in all these other places where we have been competing. Maybe one visit at the end will do it. In the end, you know, I don't think he could have won this state based on the deficit he started out with all those key constituency groups. But he also obviously didn't win the states he did target. He lost every battleground state but one. So it might have been a better play to come here more and earlier. But again, if he had, the president would have, and the advertising would have started, and they would have faced the same dynamic they did in all those other battlegrounds. And although, I'll just say, yes, you were battleground for most of our careers, but it's really drifted. Right. And part of the problem the Republicans have, and this is why some look to Governor Christie as a potentially strong candidate, is if the Democrats start with all the big northeastern states, all the big midwestern states, and California, it makes it very hard to break through in the Electoral College. So they're going to have to figure, Republicans are going to have to figure out how to break through in California, some combination of California, the Midwest, and the Northeast. And right now, you know, the things have trended the other way.
I'll name a source in this case, because it was for a magazine story that I wrote in May of 2012. I was in Chicago and sat down with Jim Messina, among others, in the Obama campaign, and he pointed out that at that point in May that the Democratic registration advantage in the state was about 350,000, and his attitude was in May was there's no way. Given the gap in the registration advantage the Democrats had at that point, there was no way for the Romney campaign, given a finite number of resources and a finite number of days, to ever catch up. And the Obama campaign believed that from the outset, and I think the Romney campaign more or less believed that too from the very beginning, and they were probably right.
Didn't David Axelrod say if the Romney took Pennsylvania, that was one of the ways reasons he was going to shave his mustache?
Yes, it was.
This was one of those states.
Yes, it was, although we got him to shave that mustache anyway.
Anyway, right. Yeah. Over here. Some big one, right there. Yes, ma'am.
Chris Christie.
Handsome.
Is he for real?
Oh, he's for real. Yeah, he's for real. There's no question about it. Look, Chris Christie is, you know, I'll try to answer this question super briefly. If you want to understand all of the potential downsides of Chris Christie, you should go buy Double Down, because there's a fair amount of reporting in the book about Mitt Romney's vice presidential vetting of Chris Christie and why
the panoply of problems that they discovered and the things that Chris Christie did not want to fully, or apparently did not want to, did not give them as much information about as they wanted, gave them enough concerns that it kept him off the Republican ticket. There are a variety of things there that are problematic, including the fact that for a while Chris Christie was could fairly be accused of having been Bernie Madoff's lobbyist, which was like a 30-second ad waiting to happen. That was one small problem for Chris Christie, but there are many things like that. On the other side of the coin, he's an incredibly compelling, charismatic guy. He has a magic to him that, you know, a different kind of magic, but he has the same kind of personal charisma that Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton had, in that he can go on, you know, Monday Night Football or The Tonight Show or the stage of this theater and hold the attention of people in a way that few other politicians can. He speaks to the upmarket and the downmarket, and you know, that's something you can't buy or sell or teach or acquire somewhere. You either have it or you don't. He also has, to go back to the earlier question, he's one of the few people who has the capacity to unite the two wings of the Republican Party. And so he's an A-list contender in 2016. No, not a sure thing by a long shot. And how he handles the new level of scrutiny he's about to come under is a totally open question and could be the biggest open question for him going forward. But he's certainly one of the, if you think about the Republican Party, A candidates and B candidates and C candidates, he's definitely in that upper bracket.
Does he, let's go to the question. I'll forget the follow-up on Christie. Let's get something else. Sir.
Who else do you perceive as being in the A-list?
Only other two people I put in A-list today are, if they run, Jeb Bush and Paul Ryan. I think those three with Governor Christie are the A-tier. They're all flawed. They've all got problems. You could list the negatives, but you could do that about anybody who's thinking about running for president. I think the field's kind of overrated. I think a lot of the other people who are talked about are far away from being ready to be full-time strong candidates and do all the things that requires, as well as possibly being commander-in-chief. There's time to grow, but I feel most of them would be starting from a position too far to go in order to get where they need to be. And I think one reason why people look at Governor Christie right now and talk so much about him is because the good chance Jeb Bush and Paul Ryan won't run for personal reasons. And that would leave Governor Christie as, by my reckoning, as the only A candidate in the race.
Somebody on this side. Yeah, right back there. Now we'll come down to you.
I'd like to ask about Paul Ryan. I was so curious after Sarah Palin with John McCain that Romney picked a person who had only won in a congressional district. And if I recall correctly, he didn't carry his own state in the election. Am I right on that? The second point, mm-hmm. that he did not carry Wisconsin for his ticket?
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little background on why Romney picked Mr. Ryan? Thank you.
Well, he picked Paul Ryan largely for personal reasons. I think he liked Paul Ryan, and they got along well, and they had a lot of chemistry. A lot of people, including Paul Ryan, thought that the reason that he was being picked was for ideological reasons, that he thought, and again, many people in the national press corps, and again, as I said, Paul Ryan himself believed that having run a campaign for a year and a half in which they tried to make the race a referendum on Barack Obama, that they had reached the conclusion that that was not working and that what they needed to do at that point was embrace the choice framing of the election and sort of say, let's offer the voters a big, bright line contrast, and Paul Ryan as the kind of ideological architect of the Republican program in Congress seemed to be a bold choice, and that would kind of clarify the stakes of the election on things like entitlements, on things like taxes, the stuff that he had championed and among House Republicans. It turned out Mitt Romney didn't really want much of that. He didn't really throw his arms around that stuff. What he really liked about Paul Ryan was that they had hit it off in Wisconsin, and he liked him in the way one of Romney's partners from Bain referred to Ryan as client ready. That was a phrase that Romney used to use about young associates at Bain, who was kind of like, he was collegial and fresh faced and had a nice handshake and didn't overshadow Mitt Romney and was solicitous to Mitt Romney. And that seems to have mattered a lot. I also will say, though, that I think Governor Romney rightly thought, which I think most presidential candidates now take as the received wisdom, is that you don't put people on the ticket to win states or to carry demographics or any of those things. You have to only do one thing with your pick, which is pick someone who the media perceives to be as ready to serve as vice president and ready to serve as president if need be on day one. And I think he looked at Ryan and thought, because of his career in Congress, that the national media would not look at him the way they looked at Sarah Palin and say, you know, not ready to be president, which they said about Sarah Palin. They did not say that about Paul Ryan, and Romney was right about that. And he thought it would reflect well on his judgment in that one regard, that he'd pick someone who was serious and credible and obviously intelligent.
Ma'am, you've had your hand up for a while. So.
You've been talking now about the candidates and earlier, and their ability to run. You just came back now to their ability to govern. And I wonder if you were writing the book on 2016 now, do you see us in a campaign moving away from the kind of vicious division, the inability to govern, the inability to compromise? Do you see any hope for 2016?
Well, I mean, it's going to be a challenge. And on the trajectory we're on now, perhaps things could change. You know, I think if President Obama did something that was big and dramatic that would unite the country, say he repelled a Martian invasion, I think it's possible. But short of something like that, I think the next president will inherit a very polarized Washington, a very polarized country, although the country's not as polarized as our Washington politics. It'll be a challenge. We both think Hillary Clinton's the most likely next president. She's a bit of a puzzle in this respect. On the one hand, when she was United States Senator, she was the most bipartisan member of the United States Congress in terms of working across the aisle, and she knows how to do that, and she has the relationships to do that. On the other hand, she has been, as First Lady and now as a potential presidential candidate, she's the most polarizing figure in the Democratic Party from the point of view of Republicans. So I don't know that she could do it. I think you could argue she's the most qualified. You could argue she's the least qualified. I don't see in any of the other people, even Governor Christie, despite his reelection here, I don't see anyone else who I think would put at the center of their campaign, bringing people together with credibility the way Bill Clinton, George Bush, and Barack Obama had. Now, maybe by the end of the president's term, someone will be positioned to do that. I think part of why I think Jeb Bush and Governor Christie are in that first tier is they do have a history of talking that way and being that way. Jeb Bush has his own special burdens because of his family, but I think that he and Hillary Clinton are the two most likely to do it. And I think, you know, at a time when the country's looking for fundamental change, what better way to pursue that than having a Bush-Clinton general election?
I wish we could end on that line, but we have time for one more question.
Okay, but to be clear, that's my best line.
Yeah, that was your best line. So remember that going out the door, okay?
Whoever's holding their hand up that has a question about Bill Clinton, let's pick that person.
Does anybody have a Bill Clinton question? There's some way in the back has a Bill Clinton question.
I saw some of the documentaries on JFK this week. They were pretty, reminiscent of when I was a young girl, and I saw a photo of Bill Clinton shaking JFK's hand. Did anybody see that photo? He was very young.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think there's going to be another JFK in our country?
Try that one out for size.
No. No, I don't, because I think you can't. I mean, part of the thing about Kennedy, and Clinton, of course, tried to appropriate a lot of that glamour and that vigor and that, you know, that picture is very famous, and he put it front and center in his campaign in 1992. The thing about John Kennedy is that, you know, beyond the incredible glow around him that has been maintained for now 50 years because of his martyrdom, you know, he also was a man with extraordinary failings, and many of them were things that no one knew in real time. He was able to be glamorous. There was able to be a Camelot because the culture of the press coverage and the culture of polarization that Mark was just talking about were nothing like as withering as they are today. There's no one who could get away with what John Kennedy got away with in the White House in terms of his personal peccadilloes, in terms of his injuries, in terms of his drug taking, in terms of his womanizing. You know, none of those things would ever be, you could never be, those things would never be glossed over again the way that they are, the way that they were then, now. And so you can't have that kind of idealized godlike figure for a very brief shining moment, but it doesn't last for very long. And I think that is the thing that will keep us from ever having another Kennedy or Kennedy-like figure again in American politics.
Yeah, it's a question of whether anybody today can survive the, what you called in the book the freak show. You know, could Kennedy have survived?
Well, the freak you can show? Survive it, but you can't survive it in a state of sanctification.
Any last word for anybody?
Well, I want to thank you all for coming again, and to repay you, I want to project forward a little bit, which we don't normally do, but over the next few weeks, you're all going to suddenly find yourself in a state of panic, not knowing what holiday gifts to get for people on your list. And I will say, I happen to know a way you can have a New York Times bestseller signed by two authors in just a matter of moments. So that's my gift to you.
And watch the HBO movie in 3 years.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.